Jason Isbell on the 400 unit live from the Ryman, Cumberland Gap. Yeah, the Ryman in Nashville. Another live one, this one from the Forum in LA, 2018, The Eagles with Hotel California. Never get tired of that song, really. And it was Sierra Hull from 25 Trips, beautifully out of place. Greg here, it's Undercurrents, back with Caravan Palace in just a minute.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Hey everybody, this is Michael Van Cleek, Vice President of KBOO's Board of Directors. The KBOO Board is recruiting new directors. KBOO's nominating committee is holding virtual information sessions from now through June. All KBOO members are eligible for board election. Black, Indigenous, and people of color are especially encouraged to apply. KBOO's Board of Directors guides the station's strategic plans and represents the interests and visions of our members. More information and meeting times can be found at kboo.fm/boardrecruiting, all one word. Thank you for considering board
service. Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with luminaries in personal development and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. In a world where we've been brainwashed to think that more is the key to happiness, more possessions, more achievements, more busyness, it's easy to lose sight of what truly matters. And this never-ending quest to accumulate possessions, experiences, and accomplishments is actually causing us to miss out on the beauty of the moment. And today we're going to be talking about how cultivating the Buddhist principle of emptiness can be the source of fundamental satisfaction in our lives. Our guest today is Billy Nguyen, author of the book, The Empty Path, Finding Fulfillment Through the Radical Art of Lessening. A student of Buddhism and mindfulness for 30 years, he received meditation teaching certification under Jack Kornfield and Tara Brach and Zen Buddhist ordination from the Zen Center of Denver, where he now teaches classes and serves on the board. He lives in Denver with his wife, children, and two dogs, Oscar and Archie. Well, hello, Billy, and welcome to the Pathways Show.
Hey, Paul, thanks very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
All right. What an interesting book, and I'm so happy to have you. You know, The Empty Path, you know, it's like a manual for what you call the art of lessening, which I guess is realizing and practicing emptiness in the texture of your daily life. What do you mean by the radical art of lessening?
Yeah, so you pointed to it with, first of all, we're trained to believe that happiness and fulfillment and meaning in our life is going to come from something outside of us that we need to go get, whether it's wisdom or experience or romance or, you know, material success, what have you. And that is always unfulfilling because it starts from with the, 180 degree false premise. We are already whole and complete from the very beginning. And anytime that we forget that, we're running around, chasing around things to try to fill a void, that we believe to be there. And nothing can do that other than this realization of what we already are. And so lessening is really, it's not, it may involve simplifying our life. It might involve, taking on a little bit less to do each day so we can be a little more patient. But really what it's about is being present and patient with the moment, appreciating what's already here so that we can still pursue our job, our family, our, these things that we choose to pursue in our life. But we know deep down that those things external to us are not the things that are going to satisfy us. We are already satisfied and at peace with ourselves from the inside out. And then when we come forth into these activities of our life, we're going to be more confident. We're going to be more creative. We're going to be more at ease. And we might actually find those things to bear a little more fruit, even though we have this attitude of kind of inherent satisfaction. So that's it in a nutshell.
Well, this idea of being satisfied from the inside out, that's great in theory. But most people, I mean, if you know anything about attachment theory, it's sort of like, I was just reading a book on attachment theory, and it said that it takes 7 months for the infant to form a secure attachment to its mother. And it's, then it said it takes like 2 years for adults to form a secure attachment with each other. And I'm wondering if in the absence of a secure attachment, not everybody got that from their mother, what is the possibility of finding this secure attachment within yourself such that lessening your attachment to external sources of satisfaction or pleasure, it seems easy or reasonable?
Yeah, well, I think that the case of relationships is a perfect, kind of way to examine this in more practical terms. And then the instance of an infant is a little bit, different. And I acknowledge that in my book when I talk about relationships and I talk about codependence and I talk about freedom and responsibility and boundaries in relationships. It doesn't really apply if you have a newborn infant who's utterly dependent on you, right? And,
exactly.
And they need to attach to you in psychological ways. So, but if you're an adult, right, you're not a newborn infant and you are responsible for yourself. And that is the truest, form of love. And I'll explain what I mean by that. So again, we are trained to believe that our partner or this person we're pursuing or, our family member, our sibling, our parent is supposed to be, help us be happy, right? To help fulfill us and to respond to us in a way that we believe is consistent with love. Right. But that, again, is a false premise. OK, we are already loved. We are already inherently whole and complete. We are not dependent on others for our satisfaction. And the same is true in the other direction. We are not responsible for other people's mental states. We are not responsible for their happiness. We are not responsible for their fulfillment. And that mutual respect and independence is the most valid form of love. So for example, right, I could say, okay, my wife, I'm going to give you this gift and, you're going to, I predict you're going to be like, oh, Billy, thank you so very much. This is so nice. You love me, right? Right. But the truth is that like, whether or not I decide to give her that gift is up to me, and how she responds to receiving that gift is entirely up to her, right? And my respect for her freedom to choose how she responds to me is love. And her respect for my freedom to choose whether or not I'm going to give her a gift, what kind of gift I'm going to give her, all that is love, right? Otherwise, we are restricting each other. We are forcing each other to conform to our preconceived idea of how the other person should be and behave in the world. And that is not love, right? That's all these other types of that is attachment, not in a good way, right?
Right.
And so as with relationships, as with other aspects of our life, but I think the rubber really meets the road in how we think about those closest to us. And it's actually one of the easiest ways to sort of demonstrate this theory.
Well, it's kind of hard to feel inspired by emptiness. If we just take the word, the English word empty, most people associate that with, some kind of void, something missing, something or meaninglessness or apathy. But Buddhism defines it quite differently. So help us out here. How do we define it?
Yeah, so part of it is a translation issue. And I think the things you just said are the reason why many people who write about Buddhism tend to skip past the issue of emptiness or give it very, you know, short shrift. It's because on its face, it doesn't sound very interesting or inspiring, and actually it sounds kind of depressing. But really, emptiness is at the core of Buddhist philosophy, and it is the reason that the fruits of compassion and love and joy that Buddhism can offer, you know, are available in the Buddhist worldview. And so what emptiness really is about is that, first of all things are impermanent. So they come into being and they eventually come out of being. Living things are born and then they die. But also, more importantly, in moment after moment, everything is always born anew. Everything is always changing. So the tree outside my window appears to be fairly stagnant. It's blowing a little bit in the breeze right now, but there's sap going up and down the trunk. The leaves are growing or dying and falling, right? The water is coming in through the roots in the ground. It's growing, it's withering. All of these things are happening all the time. And so the tree that it was when we started this conversation is different than the tree it's going to be when we end this conversation. And that's true for everything. It's true for you, it's true for me, it's true for everything that we encounter in the world. And that impermanence and ever-changingness of things is an aspect of emptiness. Another aspect of emptiness is the absence of selfhood, right? So we believe and are trained to see things as having an inherent identity that, you know, has fixed a fixed nature to it, and that, you know, like, for example, we say I'm Billy and I'm always Billy, and I, you know, these are my characteristics and these are the various aspects of my identity. But if we examine things closely and ask the question of what is it about that thing that makes it what I claim it to be, like a chair or the tree or myself. And we go through, like, what am I? My name? Am I my social security number? Am I my skin? Am I my brain? Am I my history? Am I my beliefs? I am the, you know, those things comprise this person who you're talking to right now, but none of those individually is me. So you peel back the layers of the onion and you try to find what it is that makes the self, and it's not there. And so those are two aspects of emptiness that can help us kind of relate to it a little more, you know, practically. And the result of that is that the boundaries that we perceive to be between us and the things around us do not exist. Like the you know, I'm over here, you're over there, the tree's out there. That is an illusion, because I am assigning selfhood to me, you, and the tree. That is false, right? If you examine it closely. And so the beauty of that is that we have this sense of unity in the world. You know, some of us have these peak experiences. We have, you know, maybe moments of poetry or art or beauty or whatever it might be, or some kind of spiritual practice. We have a sensation of this underlying unity to all things. And so in my belief and in the Buddhist philosophy, the reason for that is because of the emptiness of things. So emptiness is not isolation and nihilism. It is unity, and the natural fruit of that is compassion and interdependence and joy of the way that we can be in the world. And instead of this, you know, scarcity craving mindset, we have an abundance and satisfied mindset.
Okay, so you're equating emptiness as an experience of unity, whereby we realize that these boundaries or these separateness that we project onto reality is not true, and we can feel it. I mean, can you feel emptiness? You know, the absence of selfhood. What does it feel like? You know, I'm addicted to feeling good. Okay, help me out here.
yeah. It feels great. It feels great. Meditation helps. So the you know, it is difficult, you know, in our day-to-day routine and in our day-to-day habit-driven, you know, life, which is something we all have and do, to remain aware of this underlying truth of reality. Like, you know, I think we can relate to this in the sense that we went on a retreat, right? And we had some kind of spiritual insight, or, you know, we were in church, or we were whatever we do to, you know, kind of cultivate that sense of ease and peace and the proximity to what we consider to be the most real, you know, in our world and in our lives. And then we go, you know, to work the next day, and it all flies out the window, right? I mean, that's kind of the typical pattern of the human experience. But if we can cultivate our awareness of that underlying fact through dedicated practice like meditation, and we begin to not just have a cerebral understanding of what emptiness means, but a personal felt sense, a direct and intimate experience of what it is, then the boundaries between our practice, you know, on the mat and our practice and the rest of our busy, harried life starts to blur. And we start to bring that feeling and that sensation that we have in these, you know, usually rare experiences into our day-to-day. And it can calm us when we're reacting to our spouse or child. It can calm us when we're writing that email at work. I mean, it has very, very practical implications, but it does help to set aside some time, you know, to cultivate this personal relationship with this underlying reality when we have the chance.
How do you feel about psychedelics? I've done a lot of shows on psychedelics, especially lately.
Yeah.
We did one on psychedelic medicine at the end of life. It seems to me that psychedelics really facilitate the experience of emptiness like nothing else.
Yeah, I've definitely benefited from psychedelic experiences. I'm on the Colorado National Medicine Advisory Board, which is implementing the state's psychedelic therapy program.
Yeah.
So I'm definitely a believer and optimistic about the power of psychedelics, and they can be very beneficial to people, you know, in a variety of circumstances. There's, you know, spiritual applications, there's clinical applications, there's just mood applications. I do think, you know, so in the many, many psychedelic experiences I've had, some of them have been not so pleasant and probably net not good for me. But so I do think that they're, you know, we shouldn't be too careless in our use of these substances. They're powerful medicines, and they need to be taken with proper care. But I do think that there is the potential for great, great benefit for people. I will say that one reason that I became a Zen Buddhist and meditate every day is because I think that psychedelics, first of all, they can be lots of different things to lots of different people. What they are to me, what they have been for me, is like a trigger, right? Right. Kind of an opening of the doorway into another way of being in the world. And yes, an insight into that, what I now think of as underlying emptiness of all things. I didn't, you know, name it that way 20, 30 years ago when I was getting into psychedelics for the first time.
Right.
But I, you know, as Ken Kesey said in Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, he said, you can't keep going through the same door. So I don't, you know, I'm not sure that psychedelics are like a lifelong solution for spiritual fulfillment, but they can open us up to a different way of being in the world. And then we can find other tools and mechanisms for, you know, deepening it in our day-to-day life going forward.
Yeah, well, that's been my experience too. And I think that this idea that psychedelics can be helpful for psychotherapy and they could be a spiritual experience kind of points to Buddhism in my view, because there's this overlap. You know, Buddhism is like incredible psychology, and it's also a spiritual path. And so there's this like intersection between the two. That's a beautiful thing. And letting go, you know, most people think it's about letting go, but you call it lessening. And you actually say letting go doesn't really help us to let go. Speak to that, please.
Yeah, sometimes I like to be contrarian. So, and when people say letting go, they can mean, you know, by my little caveat before I launch into it, is it can mean different things to different people. But the thing that I think where letting go can be, you know, can be unhelpful is if we believe that. So take, for example, a, you know, tragic or traumatic experience in our childhood, or something that we have done, right, to another person, you know, that we carry a lot of grief and regret about. You know, we can say, I'm just going to let it go and just, you know, kind of, you know, just move on, right? And I think that's often what people mean when they say that, but it doesn't go away. You know, it's, you know, they say that the mind can forget, but the body remembers, right? I mean, it stays with us and it comes back. And when we're quote unquote triggered, and we, you know, we might feel it in our stomach or in our shoulders, or, you know, we might be reacting to a stressful situation in a way that surprises us. And what it is this undealt with trauma or tragedy or, you know, past experience that we think we've let go of, but we in fact have just, you know, hid deep down in the gut of our belly. So I think that, you know, when I talk about lessening, what I'm talking about is turning toward that experience and facing it, you know, perhaps authentically for the first time, and sincerely and earnestly and open-heartedly. And it can be painful at first, you know, certainly. And sometimes it may require, if it is truly traumatic, it might require professional support and, you know, those types of things. But to encounter it authentically and examine all of its aspects, not just the kind of habitual cycle of thought loop that we have about it, but to really look at the details of what happened and who said what, and you know, think about where they're coming from and what they're wearing, like the details of our personal embodied experience of that situation, and so that we can work with it in a new way and gradually begin to heal in a way that is, you know, honest and can allow us to approach the next moment with a more open heart is really, you know, kind of the goal.
So would you say that the idea of letting go has a sort of a false permanence to it? It's sort of like, okay, I'm done with that. Whereas lessening is more of the practice of gradually dissolving these false attachments.
Yes, yes, exactly. So you have to address the attachment in order to lessen and soften it. Right. So to me, to turn our back on something and pretend it's not there is in Buddhism, it's aversion. I mean, an attachment and aversion are two sides of the same coin, or craving and aversion, you might say, are two sides of the same coin. We're still attached to this, you know, let's just say it's something, you know, something our parents said to us when we were 15 years old or something. We're just, you know, still, and we say, well, I'm going to let it go. And it's like, you know, and just pretend it's not there. But we're still attached to it because we haven't taken the time to really soften the underlying, you know, connection that it bears to us emotionally. So lessening and in part, I think it is helpful to acknowledge that we will probably never completely expunge it from our psyche, you know, mental, emotional experience of life. Right?
Don't tell me that.
For me, that's helpful.
Don't tell me that.
Yeah, well, that's how it is for me. That's how it is for me. And I okay. worry, you know, Zen in Buddhism, this is an issue, you know, because there's this history of like the enlightened being, you know, which is a kind of mythological, idealized, frankly, you know, fantasy version of a human being who always does the right thing, right? Is completely free of their what we call past karma, which means like their memories and their, you know, their childhood experiences and all
that's
that.
That's very perfectionistic.
Exactly. It is. And it's false. Like I've never met anybody like that. Those people don't exist. And they're, you know, they exist right. in Buddhist literature, but I do not think that I've certainly never met one in my life that I could, so I can validly say that they exist. So I do think there's something powerful about acknowledging that and saying I can be free and happy anyway, right? I don't have to believe in an idealized version of a human being. I can believe in my, you know, my life actually is, with all of its trauma and, you know, crap that comes out every day, and I'm working with it and I'm on this path of lessening. But to, you know, I think that that's a healthier and true path to take than to aspire to an ideal that, in my opinion, does not exist.
Right. And one of the primary tenets of Buddhism is the law of impermanence. And I think that's such a hard thing to wrap our heads around, because we're looking for, you know, arrival at the final destination or achievement. Yeah. of enlightenment or whatever, you know, as yeah. if we're going to achieve this permanent state. So I think it's very interesting. How does impermanence and emptiness intersect?
Yeah, yeah. Well, one example I like to use, and to take what you were just saying and put it in a very practical context, is like the example of an Olympic athlete, right, who has spent their life, you know, training for this singular event and outcome, right, that they are dedicated to, and the process of training and pursuing that goal has, in as most of them will describe, largely unpleasant, right? It's grueling. They're sacrificing their childhood and their, you know, other friendships and other experiences of life for the singular goal. And almost to the person, they say that once they get there, even if they win a gold medal in the Olympics, they are deeply unhappy. And the reason for that is because all along, they never actually believed in their own inherent fulfillment and happiness. They thought that the attainment of some external goal was going to be the thing that finally solved their problems and made them happy. And surprise, surprise, you know, they were wrong. And so part of what I'm saying is that how you feel in your, you can have your career, you can have your family, you can do the things that we all do in our lives. And how we feel when we are doing them is our best indication of, you know, how it's going to feel to be in fruition with it. So for example, if we're pursuing a, you know, romantic person, right? We know what it feels like to be kind of desperate and hanging by the phone and like, nervous or whether or not they're going to call and all that kind of stuff. Well, the truth is, and I've been there, not recently, fortunately, been married for a long time and feel good about it, but I certainly can remember what it was like. Well, once we get that person, guess what? We're gonna come forth into that relationship as an insecure, person who's needy, and then when it's over, we're gonna be wildly depressed, and that's the natural arc of somebody who's not finding fulfillment and happiness from the inside out, which was my arc, in my younger days. Anyway, to get back to your original question, impermanence for me is, and this is how I approach it in the book. There's the kind of core truth of emptiness, but there's different facets of the jewel that help us see, that kind of central core component of emptiness. And impermanence is one of those things. So impermanence for me is like a feature of the underlying emptiness of things. But I think it's not, we know that we're going to die. So, I mean, that's a very stark case of impermanence that we need to confront. But the answer actually is embedded embedded in impermanence itself, which says that actually that person who dies, hopefully not soon, but let's say 40, 50 years from now, is not me, right? That's that person that, first of all the cells in my body will completely, from a materialist perspective, it's definitely not me. And from every other aspect of my mental state, the status of my relationships, the where I live, take any kind of key aspect of my life, it'll be different, probably by that time. So it's a different person, first of all, that is moving on, transitioning, whatever you want to call it at that moment, and so on and so forth, right? So embedded in impermanence, again, at the surface level, can feel like something that is a little bit scary, a little bit unnerving, something we don't actually want to think about. But if we can go deeper and look at it more closely, the resolution of what seems to be a problem is right there inside of it. So impermanence is a central plank of the broader theme of emptiness.
Well, my shades just went down because they go down automatically. It's around sunset. So
I see
anyway,
that.
I'm sorry you
Yeah.
can't see me, but that's all right. I'm here, folks.
It's beautiful. They're like glowing. Yeah.
So we only have another minute or so, and so I'm going to offer you the opportunity to share any pearls of wisdom or anything that you want for the last minute of our show today, because you have so much wisdom and I'm so appreciative. And there's so many things we haven't talked about that are in your book,
I
the art
know.
of play, about lessening our attachment to cycles of shame and blame, and your REO technique. There's just so much to learn from this book. But you got a minute, give us something.
Sure. So I'd say that, and I alluded to it earlier, but one of the things I want to call people to is my new metta prayer. It's kind of a redefinition of the traditional Buddhist metta prayer, which is sort of like, may I be happy, may I be healthy, may my friends and family be happy and healthy, and that sort of thing. So I've reframed it as really an affirmation of what we already are. So I am present, I am complete, I am worthy of love, joy, and ease, and I am free to enter the next moment with an open heart. And for me, that's how I'm thinking about my practice these days, is like, what are the steps I need to take so that I'm available to enter into the next moment with an open heart, right? And be free to respond to it in a way that is joyful and fulfilling and compassionate, not just for myself, which is important, but for, the people I encounter in the world that I live in. So
That's beautiful. Thank you
may it be
so
so.
much. And thank you for the book, and thank you for being so open and vulnerable in the book and sharing your story with the readers and how the stuff that you went through to come to this awareness. It's really beautiful. And I want to be sure to tell our listeners about your website, which
Okay.
is billywynne.com, BillyWynne.com, all one word. And you can see that in the show notes of our YouTube version of the show. And thanks a lot, Billy, for being with us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
And for those who may have tuned into Pathways late, this is your host, Paul O'Brien. Now, don't worry, you can play or share this interview whenever you want, via the internet or as a free podcast, and I'll tell you how in a minute. Today, we've been visiting with Billy Nguyen, author of The Empty Path, Finding Fulfillment Through the Radical Art of Lessening. I want to say a heartfelt thank you to all of our listeners for tuning into Pathways, which is broadcast on KBOO FM in Portland, Oregon. And or perhaps you subscribe to the podcast version for free, which you can find at divination.com. That's divination.com, as well as looking up Pathways Radio on Paulo's YouTube channel, where if you like our conversations, you can give us a thumbs up and subscribe. And please feel free to forward a link to your friends. Well, this is Paulo bidding you adieu and reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways Radio and Podcast. And thanks again to Billy Nguyen and to all of you listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways conversation.
I'm Molly, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Tune into KBOO every third Saturday at 10 p.m. for Query. Dive into the spectrum of queer music as we explore artists across time and genre.
It's on my mind every hour of every day.
That's Query,